Okay, hello everybody. It's nice to be back with you all. Sorry to be getting in just in this last minute. We had a call scheduled with Rabbi Malami, who's the head of spiritual life at the New Jewish Home in Manhattan, where our students volunteer and do chesed, and they've been hit hard by COVID. We'd have this call scheduled with him to hear how we could support the Jewish home there. Thank you for your patience. So we are going to pick up where we left off in Mishnah Sota. We did yesterday two Mishnayot, the one that was more short and to the point, the longer one in chapter six, Mishnah Gimel, that was about the legal reasoning, what your mind would have led you to if you were left to your own logical devices about how many witnesses you would need to say that a woman was defiled, nitmeit, as opposed to just secluded, where we said the stakes are so much higher in terms of actually what the consequences are for witnesses to say that a woman was defiled. And yet the verse, the pasuk, says, Eid ein ba, there was no witness there. That is the requirement for her to drink the waters, which means if there's any level of testimony, we are not quite in a situation of total doubt. And she then does not drink the waters, and even one witness is enough to establish that. So a little departure from the usual laws of testimony, but I guess it's not surprising to find a departure from usual procedures when we are in this masechet that is doing such a delicate dance. Okay, we have one more Mishnah to finish up in chapter six. Then we will move on to chapter seven, which may be a somewhat refreshing shift from what you have seen thus far. Again, we are in chapter six at the end, so Mishnah Dalet, Mishnah Sota. So we're here, number four, Mishnah Dalet. Okay, some final pieces on how many witnesses might be needed towards different ends here. Ed omer nitmeit, ve'ed omer lo nitmeit. Let's say you have one witness who says she was defiled, but you have another witness who says she was not. Or, interesting contrast here, not an aid, a witness, meaning not somebody who's usually credible to be a witness, but isha. Isha omeret nitmeit, ve'isha omeret lo nitmeit. So if a woman says she was defiled, or a woman says she was not defiled, and remember, in the rabbinic system, a woman's testimony generally is not credible in court. So if a woman says she was defiled and another woman says she was not defiled, haita shota, then she would actually drink the waters. Okay, so here we see that if there was one witness who said she was defiled, which generally, based on what we saw yesterday, would lead to a situation where she doesn't drink the waters, right? That's enough certainty that she does not drink the waters. That can be offset by just one other witness's testimony, right? Even though usually in the rules and proceedings of a court, you would need two witnesses to establish any kind of credible testimony. Here we had one witness was believed to say that she was defiled, and one other witness is enough to go in the other direction. So now we're gonna get a couple other scenarios here of counting witnesses. Second piece of this Mishnah, Echad omer nitmeit, ushnayim omrim lo nitmeit. Well, let's say one says she was defiled, but two say she wasn't defiled. Haita shota. She would drink the waters. Now, this is kind of an interesting case in the Mishnah, right, where part of what's complicated in the rules of Sota is how the usual judicial procedures around witnesses and testimony interface with the specific instruction around drinking water. And here, right, you might have thought that if there are two witnesses saying she was not defiled, that would be enough to call off the whole thing and establish that there's no concern around whether a sex act has occurred here or not. And maybe she wouldn't have to drink and she would be considered totally off the hook. There wouldn't be any suspicion at all. So what's interesting here is that when you have the one witness saying that she was defiled versus the two saying that she wasn't, that actually leaves us in a realm of doubt rather than in a realm of certainty that she was not defiled. Right? And it seems here that's because this Eir Echad, the one witness saying that she was defiled, who again comes on the heels of two witnesses saying that she'd been warned and two witnesses saying she'd been secluded, right? All of that buildup is enough to offset the two who are saying she wasn't defiled and leave us in a realm of doubt rather than certainty. Last piece. Shnayim omrim nitmet, ve'echad omer lo nitmet, lo haita shota. So if there are two witnesses to actually say that she was defiled and only one witness saying she was not defiled, she would not drink. That's because there's a level of certainty here around there having been a sex act. Okay, so those are our three cases weighing witnesses, one versus one, one versus two, two versus one, and the outcomes for each scenario. Okay, so yes, we do have the point that if she drinks, she could die. Yes, that is true according to the narrative description of this in the book of Bamidbar, but that is something that happens in the realm of God rather than the realm of human action in human hands.
But there's poison in there, right?
There's poison? Well, I don't know if they see it as poison, right? Because she may very well survive, right? The idea is that she'll only die if she's guilty.
But let's say she is guilty. So we're killing her?
Right. So I know this is one of the interesting things. And I do, if you're particularly interested in Sota and not only interested in learning Mishnah every day, you may want to check out this book by Yishai Rosenzvi, Hatekes Shelo Haya, The Right That Was Not, to see what he has to say about the Mishnah and other rabbinic works from the time period. So comparing the Mishnah to the Tosefta, right, a parallel collection of early rabbinic sources, as to whether there's a presumption of guilt or a presumption of innocence that comes through in the way the rabbinic details of this are laid out. Very hard to prove a negative is one of the comments here. Yes, and I think that might be partly why what we see as the bottom line in these Mishnayot, where there are two witnesses saying that she wasn't defiled, that actually doesn't call the whole process off here. That leads us to the next step of the waters. Okay, various comments here about the level of water purification that we might all want to have to know that we're safe drinking water. Okay, well, that's the last Mishnah here in this chapter. And I guess any other questions folks have about the way all this testimony is working, and specifically the edim, the witnesses saying that she is defiled, and not only witnesses relating to warning and seclusion. Okay, when it says she does not drink, does that mean she is presumed guilty? That is for the last case that seems to be true. So that testimony would, if there's two witnesses saying that she was defiled, that would lead to the end of that marriage and her losing her ketubah. And as was pointed out yesterday, it seems like if you have two witnesses saying she was defiled, that might even catapult us into the direction of adultery, but that would be subject to all the other laws of witnessing and warning for adultery, right? So there would have to be all the criteria meant to establish adultery there. Here, the bottom line seems to be it would certainly lead to ending the marriage and she loses her ketubah.
So were women actually killed for adultery, or is it just sort of on the books but doesn't really happen?
Right. So capital punishment in the Mishnah is another big question. Beth Berkowitz has written about this, where it's not clear at all that the rabbis had the power to institute capital punishment in the times of the Mishnah. There are some interesting statements around this in the Babylonian Talmud, and maybe there were some levels of authority given at certain times. But mostly it seems like this should be, that anything about capital punishment should be treated more as a kind of theoretical engagement with a system and less as something that was actualized. Like I said, it's not clear that any of the SOTA procedures ever happened in real historical life. Okay, does gender play any role in the 2-to-1? Good question. I assume that what's behind your question is, right, when we see that two witnesses saying that she wasn't defiled, right, can offset one witness saying that she was, would that also be true for women, even though their testimony in this system is not usually given full weight? That I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the two witness discussion here departs from the first clause where woman's testimony is treated similarly here. The one thing I will say is it seems like, right, throughout here, it seems like both women and slaves and those, right, especially people in the more kind of suspect relationship position, their testimony is being taken in order to establish that she doesn't need to drink, right? Because there's enough certainty that the sex act did occur. So I don't know, when we're looking at a case where a woman would give testimony and the result of that testimony would lead to drinking, I don't know if this, you would have that same kind of leniency in the text here. It does seem like a woman's testimony could even go in that direction, right? That the woman's testimony is also credible to say, lo nitmeit, she wasn't defiled. I guess the interesting question in this Mishnah would be, well, what if you have two male witnesses in this system, meaning two witnesses who are generally fully able to be witnesses, right, compared to two witnesses who are not of full witness status, like women or slaves, right? How would that work in this scenario? Okay, so questions, some answers, but I think it is interesting to know that the laws of SOTA are one place to explore some of the complexity around laws of witnesses in early rabbinic literature and where exceptions can be made around the usual rigid lines for edut. Okay, let's move on to chapter 7, which is a little bit more widely applicable. Chapter 7. Okay, so this is about what language you need to say particular recitations in. And right, this comes here because SOTA, in the description in the book of Bamidbar, has a fairly lengthy recitation that needs to be made. So this is going to take us out of the kind of nitty-gritties of dealing with suspicion and gender and sexuality and move towards the ritual of recitation, not only in SOTA, but also beyond. So, Mishnah Aleph. Eilu ne'amarin b'chol lashon. The following things that require ritual recitation can be recited in any language. Parashat Sota, uvidui ma'aser, kriyat shema, utfila, uvirkat hamazon, ushvuat teidut, ushvuat hapikadon. Okay, so the following can be recited in any language. The parsha of Sota. So that's why this is here, that whole lengthy thing that is recited upon drinking the waters. That can be done in any language, meaning it seems that the point is for that to be understood and not just a kind of formula. Vidoy ma'aser, the confession made at the presentation of tithes. So this, you see this in the book of Devarim, that there's a particular recitation to say when one has given of all of the different tithes. This is Devarim chapter 26, verses 12 to 19, that attests to the fact that one has actually given all of the ma'aser to all of the people who need it. So it's in the first person, right? I have given to the Levite and the stranger and the orphan and the widow. That is part of what is actually recited here. And so it seems like here also, a person needs to understand what they are saying for that to be meaningful and not just recite some sort of formula. Again, if you want to look that up in full, that's Deuteronomy chapter 26, verses 12 to 19. Kriyat Shema, recitation of Shema, actually can be done in any language. And Tefillah here in Mishnah, Tefillah always refers to the Amidah. Lots of debates about what form the Amidah took at this time in the Mishnah. It's not clear in all stages of the Mishnah that it had fully fixed language at all. It could have been much more free form than what we know, or it could be that just the closings of each blessing were fixed, but anything else in that blessing was more freeform and improvised. And so that is in any language. Berkat HaMazon, grace after meals. The Shvuat Edut, a vow that one takes concerning testimony that they have given, right? That they are being honest in testimony, that is in any language. And Shvuat HaPikadon, an oath that one makes regarding a deposit. If somebody has left a deposit in your possession, and something happens to that deposit, the person who had the deposit in their home makes an oath that they were not negligent. It's not because of anything they did wrong, and that they don't want to be liable to pay back the original owner. And that oath also is in any language. Okay, I'm going to engage with the questions in just a minute, but I do just want to say, right, an interesting facet of Mishnaic Hebrew is that it's not clear when you have the language of Elu Ne'amarin, these are said, whether that is these may be recited, as the English translation from Sefaria offers here, or Elu Ne'amarin, these should be recited in any language. It's actually ambiguous linguistically, and I think conceptually could also be unclear whether there's any preference to saying these in Hebrew, if that's possible, or whether there's actually a preference to saying all of these things in a language that is fully understood. So this Mishnah is really the root of a whole lot of debates in the modern period that have kind of played out in various denominational settings and committees on how to create a Siddur, whether language, how language should play into those choices around. Right, okay, so in the Mishnah, Tefillah and Shema are different. Shema is called, is referred to as Kriyat Shema, reciting the Shema, and Tefillah, the word Tefillah, specifically refers to the Amidah. Think of how much shorter Shacharit would be if it was just those components.
Is the Shema and Tefillah, Amidahs spoken separately? They're at different times of the day?
Right, so I mean, it's a somewhat later development, though it is discussed in the Talmud for sure, the idea of juxtaposing Shema and Tefillah that comes out of the infrastructure of the blessings for Shema, and specifically the blessing after Shema, the blessing about redemption. That's where we have the Talmud talking about it's cited as more of a pious practice of juxtaposing that blessing for redemption with the Amidah, which, I mean, we can talk about, there's a lot to say about that concept that you sort of enter into the Amidah after this blessing about redemption. It sort of frames the Amidah through the lens of redemption, but that is a later development. Before that, there was an obligation for Shema, there was an obligation for Tefillah that was the Amidah, and they later get woven together through the blessings of Shema. The question of Ne'amarin as should or may, if anyone wants to weigh in by raising hand or chat, on the question of whether your instinct would be that it's preferable that these be in Hebrew, but there's an allowance for them to be in any language, or if actually it might be that it's preferable for these to be in a language that is understood, and it might be inappropriate for something to be in Hebrew if it will not be understood by the reciter. Yeah, Maxine?
My instinct would definitely be that, like, I want this Mishnah to be the ones that you need to understand emotionally, and therefore you can say them in your own language, and then the next Mishnah I want it to be, like, ritual formulations, and so we consider them, like, less important. But I'm having a hard time making that claim because chalitza is in the next one, and I would say that, like, you know, saying that I'm not going to marry you is actually very, very personally important, and so I would think of all the things, I would say chalitza in my own language.
Great. So maybe what we'll do is read through the next Mishnah that gives the other side and then come back to this question. Okay, here we go. Mishnah Bet, in contrast. Ve'elu ne'amarin bilshon ha'kodesh. So these things, on the other hand, are recited right in Hebrew. Seems like must be recited in Hebrew. Mikra bikurim, the recitation of bringing bikurim that we now know from our Haggadah on Passover, right, telling the story when you bring your Bikurim, Arami Oved Avi, my father was that wandering Aramean, or however we want to translate that, that recitation that is found in Devarim chapter 26, 5 to 11, must be done in Hebrew. Chalitza, if in a levirate marriage, the brother-in-law decides he does not want to marry the sister-in-law, or if she decides that she does not want the marriage, then chalitza happens to end that relationship, which involves taking off a shoe, and the recitation that the brother-in-law does not want to build up his brother's line. Brachot uklalot, the blessings and curses that are recited when the people go into the land, when Bnei Israel go into the land and they have the blessings and curses, Har Grizim and Har Eval on those two mountains. Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing that we know. Birkat Kohen Gadol, the blessing of the high priest, which was recited on Yom Kippur when he was inside the Kodesh Kodashim. In that innermost chamber, there was an elongated blessing that the Kohen Gadol would give. Parashat HaMelech, the specific recitation for the king, but this is part of what's recited in the gathering of Hakel that would happen, right, not every year. Parashat Egla Arufa, when the elders have to convene to deal with an unsolved murder case that's outside the city, then they need to say, our hands did not spill this blood. That is actually done in Hebrew. Mashuach milchama b'sha'a shemidaber el ha'am. And the priest who's anointed to accompany people into battle and gives a recitation about all the people who are exempt and can go home, somebody who's been married in the past year, etc. When he's speaking to the people, that is actually done in Hebrew. So that is our list. And it's an interesting list. I think part of what Maxine is pointing to is, would you have necessarily arrived at these two different clusters of things? Or does it seem like there's some things on one list that you might have imagined to be better placed on the other list, whether because of your own intuition about the function of that as ritual versus speech and communication, or maybe part of how we've come to inherit these things, right, where I think we're sort of used to Kriyat Shema being something that, of course, you're going to teach your kids that those will be the words that they might know in Hebrew, even if they don't know anything else in Hebrew. The Mishnah actually doesn't necessarily point in that direction. It might be that everybody reads through the section of the Haggadah there in English that quotes this Birkat Mikra Bikurim, that recitation about bringing first fruits, that this Mishnah is actually saying would be in Hebrew, though in the context of of bringing first fruits, not in the context of the Haggadah. So I think it's an interesting list that sort of requires probing why the lines are drawn this way. But maybe an interesting thing to do with this Mishnah is to kind of lean in to the surprise around why something is on a different list than you would have expected. And it might open up new ways of understanding whether that is supposed to be more ritualized or more about comprehension, communication. Right, interesting. So there's a lot that's not on either list. So lots of things that we think of as having a certain formulation that just aren't on the list. And so, okay, that is definitely one thing that needs to be probed, right? Are these paradigms? And if so, how do you fit in other data that's not on these lists, including the marriage formula? So, okay, and Judah's bringing in, you might draw differences between public and private prayer, that the vernacular can maybe only happen when you're in public, but for private prayer, you might need to be more careful about Hebrew. Yes, that's an interesting piece that makes it into the Shulchan Aruch as well. And some of that is, right, maybe in private, we need to have some sort of structure that in public, that structure is being offered by literally the structure of the space. So it could be that holding on to Hebrew is a way to insert some kind of ritual structure into something that would otherwise be totally freeform. Okay, Carla points out the Hebrew seemed to be connected to areas involving God's cooperation or intervention. So God's blessing, God giving atonement for the elders. That's an interesting thing, right? It's always an interesting exercise to try to find a thread that ties everything together. I think we'd usually find that could explain pieces of what's on a list, but maybe not the whole list. Right? I don't know that chalitza, ending that marriage, is something where you'd say there's God's cooperation or intervention necessarily. But yes, I think, right, you can imagine how you could write a whole page of Talmud or multiple on these Mishnayot. But I do think they are particularly important to have in mind with all of the debates about language these days as well. Okay, good to see you all. Have a great afternoon. And we'll jump in to Mishnah Gimel tomorrow. Take care.